Welcome back to the Steve Gruber Show with Jordan Lofthouse. He is a research and policy analyst at Strata. Now, that's a think tank for Utah State University in Logan, Utah. Jordan is a native of Idaho and was raised near Yellowstone National Park, where he has previously worked as a guide. There's a new study out accompanying a documentary film released on how Yellowstone National Park is being wrecked by bureaucrats driven by politics rather than science and ecology. Jordan, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to be back.
So Yellowstone National Park, I went to Montana State University and in Bozeman, and I also worked at the time for a couple of radio stations in that town. And during 1988 and 89, I was in and out of Yellowstone National Park numerous times during the great firestorms of 1988 and then the aftermath in 89 and 90. And so I've got to know the park really well. And I agree with the premise or the outcome of the study, which is that politicians who know little or nothing about science try to play God with things that they have little understanding of in an effort to, I don't know, appease their constituents. Am I on the right track?
Yeah, you're on the right track there. I think, to be fair, the National Park Service does employ biologists, scientists, different chemists even. You know, they have a lot of different scientists there. But when it really comes down to making the overall management decisions, those are more dictated by politics and personal preferences rather than science.
So when you talk about different policies, one of the policies that I was very aware of was the policy involving forest fires. There was a period of time, a century or more, as you know, where all forest fires were put out. Smoke jumpers would come in. Didn't matter the cause, whether it was caused by a lightning strike or a campfire. The smoke jumpers were in there. They went in there. They stopped it as quick as they could, and they moved on. Today, the only forest fires they would put out are ones that are man-made, and they had a let-it-burn policy, which in large part led to those giant fires of 1988 because so much fuel had built up over the decades. The end result was a giant fire, bigger than what they would have had if they had just let the forest, you know, burn and regenerate normally. But that's not the way the politics played out, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So ever since Yellowstone became a national park in 1872, people didn't really want to go to a burnt or a burning park. And so the management decision was to suppress all fires as soon as they started. And they kept doing that almost for a whole century. They would just suppress every fire. And Yellowstone is actually a very fire-dependent ecosystem. It needs fire to be healthy. So when 1988 rolled around, a really dry year, and it was a tinderbox. It just basically exploded. Everything burned up. So,
yeah, I mean, it went crazy. And the point that you make that people here in the eastern United States and in Michigan may not even realize, Jordan, is that lodgepole pines, for example, for their cones to open, the temperature has to be 120, 125 degrees. So they only regenerate by way of fire. Otherwise, the cones don't open up. The seeds are not released unless there is a forest fire. And then following a forest fire in places like Yellowstone in the western U.S., you get a fresh crop of young grass and different things that move in, which attracts deer and elk and other wildlife. It is a whole cycle of life caused by fire.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And fire, even historically, for thousands of years in Yellowstone, fire has had two sources. One is natural, you know, lightning that causes fires. But also Native Americans have lived in Yellowstone for thousands of years. They actively burned the park for their own benefit to clear meadows for hunting, to kind of open up the undergrowth so you could see, you know, an approaching enemy or, you know, an approaching bear even. So the management decisions for the past 100 years haven't really reflected the true history of Yellowstone. We kind of omit the history we don't want to see, and we make Yellowstone into a place that we want it to be.
So I think the takeaway that I keep getting from this conversation, Jordan, and we're with Jordan Lofthouse from Utah State University, is that science and politics, as a general rule, do not mix well.
Yeah, I think science can inform management decisions, but the people who make the management decisions are themselves bureaucrats, and they're constrained by a whole system. Even if they have good intentions, the good intentions can't always come out, or if they try to implement good intentions, unintended consequences can result. So it's just a big, messy system.
It is a big, messy system. And we are on the line with Jordan Lofthouse, a research and policy analyst at Strata, a think tank at Utah State University. So other issues that come to mind are the buffalo herds, or bison, if you will, and the North American elk herds, which, according to most biologists, are well beyond their carrying capacity in Yellowstone National Park. Now, some of that has been brought back into line by the reintroduction of the wolves in the mid and late 1990s, not only to Yellowstone, but the Selway Bitterroots in Idaho that have also spilled back across towards the park and different wolf populations. But still, the Yellowstone National Park, like where the native cutthroat trout were in these little streams and where they would spawn, have been beaten down by overgrazing of these large animals and created problems for all sorts of species. Again, because visitors to the park wanted to see elk and bison and everything else, but it was to the detriment of the ecosystem oftentimes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I grew up about an hour outside Yellowstone. I used to be a tour guide there, so I've seen all of this firsthand. And what you see in Yellowstone when you go there is you walk along the rivers, and normally in that kind of ecosystem, you'd see a whole bunch of willows along the riverbanks. In a lot of places in Yellowstone, you can't see a single willow for miles. And so really it's this overgrazing in Yellowstone is the result of 100 years worth of management decisions that have led to cascading effects that have led to our current state in Yellowstone.
Well, there are groups that would like to, you know, shoot down the population of elk and bison and so forth, but those operations usually get shut down by anti-hunting groups, and animal rights groups often step in and interfere with the with what would be the proper management of these animals. Because it is, let's be honest, it is not wilderness. It's a national park. It's multi-use land in the western United States, which means, it, as it says at the entrance of the park, it's for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. It's not just to be, you know, they don't, some of the animal rights people, I believe, environmentalists, would run a fence around Yellowstone National Park and not let anybody in forever. That would be their choice. It's not really the way it works, though.
Yeah, it's not really how it works. I mean, deciding what Yellowstone or any national park should look like is really based down to personal preferences. I mean, some people are kind of channeling the spirit of John Muir. They want Yellowstone to remain, you know, this wild temple, whereas other people want Yellowstone to be more like a natural Disneyland. They just want to take a stroll and see some geysers and not get dirty. It's like, which is the correct viewpoint? Well, either are valid, but what it comes down to is, what are the viewpoints and the incentives of the decision makers who can actually impose their preferences on the rest of us? And that comes down to the National Park Service deciding what they want the Yellowstone to look like.
Well, what do you think is the right approach? I'm more of a John Audubon kind of a guy, which is you need to study and protect the animals, but you do that with a Browning M5 to put the bird on the ground so you can actually understand what the bird is like. I'm more of that school of thought. Where does that put me?
You know, I think there's a whole range of viewpoints. Some people do want Yellowstone just to be purely a wilderness. I'm sure some people would be happy if no people ever went into Yellowstone. Other people want complete hunting in Yellowstone. They want to pave everything over. I'd say somewhere in the middle is probably good to keep most people happy.
Somewhere in the middle, yeah. And it comes back to this whole concept of multi-use land, which is, you know, and thinking outside of Yellowstone, but it's some people want to use ATVs. Some people want to use horses only. Some people want to walk. Some people want to, you know, use a motorcycle. And you have all these competing different factions for use inside of a national park as well, and what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. You know, in most national parks, like Yellowstone Lake is the largest lake of that size at that elevation anywhere in the world. And it's a non-motorized lake. You can see Yellowstone Lake all you want if you got a paddle.
Exactly. So I think the problem with, I mean, there's just always going to be problems with publicly owned land. If everyone owns it, then everybody has a say. And if everybody has a say, it makes decisions really hard to make. So, I mean, people with subjective opinions come together to make decisions, and they make those decisions through politics. And as we know, politics is ugly and messy, and our results are sometimes ugly and messy.
We're with Jordan Lofthouse, a research and policy analyst at Strata, a think tank for Utah State University. All right, so your takeaways from this study, if you will, Jordan, what is the future not only of Yellowstone National Park, but of all the national parks in America, whether it's one like Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado or Smoky Mountain National Park, which is the largest and most visited park of all the national parks? What is the future? I mean, there's competition, I think it's fair to say, from different politicians, different users, different special interests for how these parks are used. We've outlined it very well here in this discussion, but what's the future, do you think?
I think people are becoming more aware of national parks, and I think people are loving national parks more than they ever have. I think the important thing here is when people go to national parks, they really need to consider who's making decisions and why they're making the decisions they are. Sometimes there's an interesting law that guides how national parks are governed. It's called the Organic Act. It says that the National Park Service has to promote recreation and conservation. Sometimes those two things don't go, they kind of mix like oil and water. If you promote conservation, you have to restrict recreation. And if you promote recreation, you can't conserve as much. So there's always going to be trade-offs, and I think the public's going to have to decide what we want those trade-offs to be.
I think that is important. I think that, there's a lot of tremendous land out there, and America has done something better than, I believe, any country in the world. That's the preservation of land, the stewardship and conservation of wild game species. I mean, we have more deer and elk and antelope than we've had in a century, maybe more than ever in some instances. Wild turkeys are at all-time record numbers, so are white-tailed deer. So I think the stewardship and the conservation approaches we've used thus far have, by and large, worked, but the competition and the give and take and the tug of war will likely continue. I'll give you the last word, Jordan.
Yeah, I think the last word is really, we need to really consider, kind of go away from what the intentions are. What need to avoid looking at just the intentions and look at the actual outcomes. Have our politically motivated policies led to unintended consequences? And if there are bad consequences, how do we fix those?
Fair enough. Great conversation, and I greatly appreciate you taking the time, Jordan. It's a good study. If people want to find the study and read more and understand more and think more about the ecosystems and the national parks of the United States, where would you send them?
You can visit us at strata.org, and we'll have everything up there.
Strata.org. Jordan Lofthouse, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.